Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. The state and federal governments have both launched investigations into corruption allegations at the California Public Utilities Commission. We'll have details coming up soon on this story and other top news. You'll hear about controversies involving two local congressmen, one accused of sexual harassment by an aide, and the other under fire for claiming that ISIS fighters have been apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border, a claim that Homeland Security says is false. If you or someone you know participated in the Del Mar Mud Run, listen up. The county is looking for anybody who can identify a runner and possibly others who handled a bat that's since been tested and found to have rabies. We'll have a weather report and news about the San Miguel Firefighters' Empty the Boot campaign to promote wildfire awareness and safety. You'll also hear a heartwarming story about a family that started a foundation to provide free heart screenings to teenage athletes after losing their own son to sudden cardiac arrest. There will be screenings coming up in Spring Valley. Our newsmaker interview today is with Vicki Butcher, Executive Director of Water for Children Africa. She'll be talking about the good works her nonprofit is doing to help children in Africa and also about an Africa trade conference coming up this week in San Diego, where an exciting new technology to derive drinking water from air will be demonstrated. In our agricultural report, hear why the state is cracking down on wineries using volunteer workers and what that could mean for the winemaking industry. On Tribal Beat, hear why some students want San Diego State University to lose its Fear the Spear slogan and its Aztec warrior symbol. In our bookshelf section, Raina Menashe interviews Kirk Lee Ader, author of Child of the Storm, How an Angry Young Man Found a Bond with the Sea and Changed Our Lives Forever. The book tells the story of Chris O'Rourke, a San Diego surfing champion. Plus, hear where you can go for early voting to cast your ballot before the November election. And hear about a rare bird that's been added to the endangered species list. So stay tuned for these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. State and federal authorities have launched investigations into the California Public Utilities Commission over rate-setting procedures and oversight of Pacific Gas and Electric Company regarding the deadly San Bruno pipeline explosion. The Sacramento Bee reports that California Attorney General Kamala Harris has launched a probe and that the regulatory agency has been ordered to preserve records. In addition, the U.S. Attorney's Office has notified PG&E of a separate investigation into private communications between the CPUC and PG&E, which suggests that state regulators were trying to help PG&E avoid tough penalties for the fatal explosion. After exposure of internal emails revealed the inappropriate communications, CPUC Chairman Michael Peavy, who is a former PG&E executive, announced that he will resign at year's end. PG&E has also fired several executives in the wake of the scandal, but ratepayer advocates say that's not enough. Despite Peavy's announcement that he won't seek reappointment when his term expires December 31st, the San Diego Reader reports that the CPUC plans to proceed with a final vote on a plan to make ratepayers pick up the $3.3 billion cost of closing the San Onofre nuclear plant. Mike Aguirre, former San Diego City Attorney, has suggested that Peavy has shown favoritism to utilities in that case as well. When Aguirre tried to ask Peavy during a public meeting about allegedly secret meetings with utilities on the matter, Peavy refused to answer and shouted at Aguirre to shut up. Now Aguirre is blasting the CPUC for what he calls corruption. According to the Reader, Aguirre says the corrupt element is attempting to rush through an approval favoring the utilities for which they work. This is corporate criminal behavior. While the legislature could legally vote to oust Peavy, the legislative session for this year has ended. Don Bowder, the Reader reporter who has long reported on CPUC scandals, agrees that the CPUC conduct is, quote, criminal, unquote. In comments that he posted after his latest story, Bowder agrees that the San Onofre shutdown was management's fault and that ratepayers should not have to pay a cent. Bowder offers this advice to ratepayers. This vote could possibly be blocked if enough Edison and SDG&E ratepayers raise enough hell, he says. He suggests that ratepayers demand Commissioners Peavy and Floria not be allowed to vote, since both have been accused of serious conflicts of interest and corruption, and because the agency is now under investigation by both the Attorney General and the U.S. government over the San Bruno offenses. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
In a city still reeling from the sexual harassment scandal that led to the resignation of Mayor Bob Filner, sexual harassment allegations have now surfaced in a high-profile San Diego congressional campaign. Todd Bosnich, a former staffer for Republican congressional candidate Carl DiMaio, claims that DiMaio called him into his office and masturbated in front of him. Bosnich claimed he was also harassed by DiMaio on other occasions, including a crotch-grabbing incident, Voice of San Diego reports. DiMaio is running against incumbent Democratic Congressman Scott Peters. DiMaio has denied the allegations and claims Bosnich made them up after being fired for plagiarism. The congressional candidate has also accused Bosnich of a break-in at the campaign office. But Bosnich says he was fired only after he complained to DiMaio's chief of staff about the harassment. He says he was offered $50,000 to keep quiet, but refused to take the money. According to a CNN report, Bosnich had passed a lie detector test and provided results to the national media outlet. DiMaio claimed to have taken a lie detector test, but did not provide CNN with proof. This isn't the first time DiMaio has been accused of inappropriate sexual conduct. Last year, State Senator Ben Hueso told media that when he was serving on the city council, he saw DiMaio masturbating in a public restroom at City Hall. Councilwoman Marcy Emeril reportedly confirmed that Hueso told her about it at the time and suggested he report it to the police, as this would violate city law. But Hueso did not do so. There are clear parallels to the Filner case. Though unlike Filner, DiMaio has flat-out denied the sexual harassment allegations. But both officials have reputations for treating employees poorly and even bullying them. Voice of San Diego reports that DiMaio alienated former campaign staffers and his ex-chief of staff at City Council. The UT San Diego reports that DiMaio claims San Diego Police Chief Shelley Zimmerman told him in August that the Bosnich claim was deemed unfounded and that the investigation closed. However, San Diego Police Department spokesman Lieutenant Kevin Meyer said on Thursday that the department will not discuss the investigation details and that no further information is being released at this time. No criminal charges have been filed against DiMaio. District Attorney Bonnie Dumanis ran against DiMaio in the mayoral primary race, but later endorsed him after her loss. If charges are filed against DiMaio, Dumanis would likely recuse herself from handling the case, just as she did when sexual harassment charges were filed against Bob Filner, who defeated DiMaio to win the mayoral race. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Keith Langhorn.
This is Miriam Raftery with an update on some controversial remarks made by Congressman Duncan D. Hunter that have sparked discussions in national news media after Hunter claimed that ISIS or ISIL terrorists have been apprehended crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. Hunter told Greta Van Susteren on Fox News that, quote, "I know that at least 10 ISIS fighters have been caught coming across the Mexican border in Texas," unquote. He said he got the information from a confidential Border Patrol source, but multiple sources in the U.S. and Mexico later said Hunter got it wrong. Homeland Security spokesperson Marsha Catron told East County Magazine, "The suggestion that individuals who have ties to ISIL have been apprehended at the southwest border is categorically false and not supported by any credible intelligence or the facts on the ground." Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson told CNN that he personally reviews intelligence reports daily from the southern border as well as overseas to be on the lookout for something of that nature. He stated, "We have no specific intelligence that ISIL is planning to come into the U.S. through our southern border." UT San Diego reported that the Mexican embassy called Hunter's statement, quote, "categorically false." The Mexican embassy's statement added, "Mexican authorities have no indication whatsoever of the presence of groups or individuals of Islamic extremists in Mexico."
Gabe Pacheco, spokesman for the Border Patrol Agents Union, told UT San Diego that the San Diego sector has not received any information about any terrorist apprehensions in Texas. And Congressman O'Rourke of Texas told MSNBC that he was assured by Homeland Security that no apprehensions of ISIS fighters on the border occurred. Now, CNN reported after the media aired these contradictions that Congressman Hunter spokesman Joe Casper confirmed that Hunter stands by his statement and that a high-level source told Hunter that the Department of Homeland Security is actively discouraging any talk about ISIS at the border. Last month, Homeland Security issued statements to debunk claims made by other conservative politicians who speculated that ISIS was planning to enter the U.S. from Mexico. But now, it turns out, there is a kernel of truth to Hunter's assertion that some with ties to terrorism have been intercepted at the U.S.-Mexico border, although they were apparently not ISIS members. The conservative site Judicial Watch posted a variation on Hunter's story recently, claiming that four ISIS operatives were taken into custody last week at the border. Homeland Security Secretary Johnson has now clarified that four people told border officials that they were members of the Kurdistan Workers' Party. The Kurds are currently fighting against ISIS. However, the Kurdistan Workers' Party is on the State Department and NATO's terrorist watch list, and the individuals, four of them, not ten, are being deported, according to Homeland Security. However, Homeland Security's secretary reiterates that there is still no evidence of ISIS members attempting to cross our border. ISIS, which calls itself the Islamic State, invaded Iraq from Syria and has captured multiple cities. The ruthless group has killed and brutalized those who refuse to convert to Islam, forcing at least 1.5 million people to flee their homes. Duncan Hunter is a Republican who represents the 50th Congressional District, which includes portions of San Diego and East County.
This is Keith Langhorne with an important health bulletin from the County of San Diego. The county's Health and Human Services Agency is asking for the public's help to identify people who may have been exposed to rabies during the Del Mar Mud Run at the Del Mar Fairgrounds on Saturday, October 4th. A runner said that a bat had landed on him during the run. The bat was captured and submitted to the county for rabies testing, and the county public health laboratory confirmed the bat was infected with rabies. County health officials are concerned that the runner and other people may have directly handled the rabid bat. Anyone who knows the identity of the runner who discovered the bat or anyone who believes they were potentially exposed to the bat are urged to contact the County of San Diego Health and Human Services Agency as soon as possible at 619-692-8499. Health officials would like to interview anyone who may have come in contact with the bat as soon as possible to determine if they were potentially exposed to rabies. Event participants and observers that had no contact with the bat are not at risk for rabies. Rabies is a preventable viral disease that is most often transmitted through the bite of a rabid animal. Although rare, transmission may also occur if the saliva from a rabid animal comes in contact with a person's eyes, nose, mouth, or open wound. Symptoms of rabies in people can take weeks or even months to develop after exposure to a rabid animal has occurred. Once symptoms develop, rabies is almost always fatal. However, prompt treatment following exposure to the virus will prevent the disease.
This is Leon Thompson with a weather report from East County Magazine on KNSJ. A cooling trend is coming in this week as a trough of low pressure arrives along the west coast. Night and morning low clouds will continue in our inland valleys and along the coast, with temperatures dipping into the 60s at night and the low 80s during the day. The humidity is also rising. Good news during fire season, and according to the National Weather Service, some patchy drizzle is possible by Tuesday night or Wednesday morning.
For years, firefighters have helped raise money to assist worthy organizations such as the Muscular Dystrophy Association by asking residents to fill the boot. On Tuesday, San Miguel Fire District and its partner Cal Fire will reverse that tradition by taking to street corners and shopping malls and asking residents to empty the boot. The boots will be filled with important wildfire preparedness information and safety-related items for the children. This is a continuing effort to make sure residents have all the tools they need to protect their families, homes, and community from the ravages of wildfires, says Leonard Villarreal, community outreach coordinator for the district. San Miguel and CAL FIRE will launch this unique public education outreach Tuesday with a kickoff in Rancho San Diego at the intersection of Hamasha and Campo Road. The Empty the Boot campaign will be followed up with the San Miguel CAL FIRE Safe and Sound Expo, and that will be held this Saturday, October 18th, at the Rancho San Diego Town Center. A press release from the fire district advises residents that 3 years of severe drought and a continuous series of extremely hot temperatures requires all of us to pull together to provide as much awareness as possible to the community. With each effort, more and more residents join the line of wildfire defense. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
5 years ago, Steel Canyon High School athlete Eric Parades died of sudden cardiac arrest at age 15. One of 7,000 kids across America who die of the syndrome each year when their hearts stop beating without warning. Sudden cardiac arrest is fatal in 92% of cases. Young athletes are at 60% greater risk, but cardiac screenings can identify the heart abnormalities that lead to sudden cardiac arrest. In his memory, Eric Parade's family started up the EP Save a Life Foundation to help save the lives of others. So far, the EP Save a Life Foundation has screened more than 14,000 teens, finding 1 in 100 with a heart abnormality that unknowingly put them at risk for sudden cardiac arrest. To mark the 5th anniversary of Eric's passing, the Eric Parades Save a Life Foundation will host free heart screenings at Steel Canyon High School on Sunday, November 2nd from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Parents can register teens for the free screening at epsavealife.org, where they download a screening packet, complete, and bring to the event. SCA is not a heart attack. It's an abnormality in the heart's electrical system that may be detected with a simple EKG. Even though the first symptoms of SCA could be death, screenings are not part of youth health checkups or pre-participation sports physicals, which is why Eric's Foundation provides free heart screenings to area teens, say Hector and Rina Parades, founders of Eric's Foundation. The November 2nd event at Steel Canyon High School in Spring Valley also features a Red Cross certified team that will demonstrate how easy it is to learn hands-only CPR and how to use an automated external defibrillator, the only two life-saving measures once SCA strikes. Screenings include a health history questionnaire completed by a parent, an electrical cardiogram or EKG, and if indicated, an echocardiogram. It takes less than 30 minutes and it's painless and non-invasive. Screenings are conducted by a 100-member volunteer team of San Diego cardiologists, nurses, techs, and other staff led by the Foundation's medical director, Dr. John Rogers, a Scripps cardiologist who was recognized nationally by a Parent Heart Watch as a 2014 Hero for Young Hearts and as a healthcare champion in San Diego. Teens who have the screening done will also get free Subway sandwiches and a free meal at the kebab shop, as well as discounts at Sports Authority. Established in 2010, the non-profit EP Save a Life Foundation hopes to ultimately see cardiac screenings for youths at all schools, as well as equipping all schools with defibrillators and providing CPR and defibrillator training for students and staff. For more information, you can visit epsavealife.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Keith Langhorn.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Water is one of the most critical issues facing California as well as places around the world, such as Africa. And I am delighted today to welcome our special guest, Vicki Butcher, the founder and executive director of Water for Children Africa. Vicki, thank you for joining us.
It's a real pleasure, Miriam, especially to talk about my passion, water.
Yes. Now, listeners, you're going to be hearing all about the good works that Water for Children Africa is doing to save lives over there. But you're also going to be hearing about a very special conference called the Africa Trade and Business Conference that is coming up on October 18th right here in San Diego. And among the featured speakers is going to be an expert telling us about a technology for creating drinkable water from air.
Yes, Miriam, and we're so pleased to have a person to join us from Honolulu, Hawaii, that is actually using this type of technology on the island.
Amazing. We're going to hear all about that in just a few moments, and also how it could be applicable right here in drought-stricken California and San Diego as well. But first, Vicki, for listeners who may not be familiar, can you tell us a little bit about Water for Children Africa, what the mission is, and some of the good works you're doing?
Thank you so much for asking. The Water Project was started because 85% of the children that die on the continent of Africa die from diseases directly related to contaminated water. 30,000 children die daily from water-related diseases. And the sad part of this is that they are all preventable by giving safe, sustainable, sanitary drinking water.
So how is Water for Children Africa helping to solve that situation in some of these rural areas?
We partner with the village. We partner with the leadership. We ask them a simple question. How can we help you to get the water that you need? And they do know, and they tell us what we can do. And generally, they're simple, low-tech solutions. And those solutions mean that instead of walking the women who are really and truly women and girls, beast of burdens, who walk up to three hours a day to get just to get the water that they need in order to have drinking water, water to clean their homes, water to clean their bodies. And we support getting water in the village to alleviate those long distance walks and also to get water that is healthy for their bodies.
So creating infrastructure, things like drilling wells maybe, or building, water piping to bring water in, what do you do?
We actually support them in boring holes, as they call it, or drilling wells. Mm-hmm. And we also help them to buy water catchment tanks to take in to at least 10,000 liters of water, rainwater. People often ask, how do you fill the tanks? We are blessed that we allow God to fill the tanks.
Marvelous. They have rain over there. I'm like, here. Huh?
Yes, yes.
Now, it's also important not only simply for drinking water and preventing people from walking these long distances, but also actually saving lives, as you've touched on, preventing waterborne diseases. But in addition to stopping things like, say, typhoid or diphtheria, I understand that sanitation is also important in preventing the spread of Ebola.
Sanitation and hygiene are so important for the health of the continent, for preventing Ebola, as well as malaria, as well as diarrhea, and as well as other waterborne illnesses. The thing that Water for Children has found out in the many years that we have been going, we were incorporated in 1993, and we have been going to Africa at least once a year, sometimes more than once a year, in order to work with projects. But we know that water anchors good health, but sanitation and hygiene must partner with water. So we have extended our outreach to building latrines in the schools, mm-hmm. two for the girls, two for the boys, and including a hand washing station, as well as having written a small book on why the children must wash their hand, and we have translated that into 5 languages.
Very good.
Yes, so that the children can see that although they don't see the germs on their hands, it's so important. And the children, in turn, go home and teach their parents that they must wash their hands as well.
You also bring actual medical help there, as I understand, too. Your husband, of course, is a very well-known, prominent physician.
Actually, we have understood that taking just simple over-the-counter medications has been extremely helpful. Last year, we had a student who is in her senior year in pharmacy school. She went with us on our visit, went back into the village, determined what medications the people could use, and went to the clinic, procured them, and took them back into the village.
Very good. Yes. Now, you also bring students locally with you on these trips. Tell
Miriam,
us about that.
Yes, we know that in order to solve the many problems that we see, that it will take our future generations. The only way that they will even be vested in dealing with these issues and problems is for them to go and see them. So every trip, we must have students. We've taken students from Granite Hills High School, from Helix mm-hmm. High School, Patrick Henry, and from the various colleges, and we help them to raise the funds that will allow them to pay the cost, because the ticket is really quite expensive.
Yeah.
Prohibits really quite a bit of tourism that people might otherwise find themselves going to the continent.
Yeah, and it's a marvelous and very satisfying experience for the local students. I know I've talked to some people who've done that, and they really found it to be heartwarming. Now, let's talk a little bit about the conference coming up. It's the 18th Annual Africa Trade and Business Conference, listeners, that's going to be held on October 18th at San Diego City College.
Yes. Miriam, we partner with higher education institutions in order to focus on the educational aspect of what we need to be exposed to about the continent. We will feature a speaker that will talk about Ebola, the Ebola virus.
Yeah, I understand that's the United Nations representative, Dr. Eric Kashambuzi?
Dr. Kashambuzi will speak on development issues, and he is a consultant to the United Nations in New York, but he is a Ugandan, mm-hmm. and he was educated. His postgraduate education was at mm-hmm. UC Berkeley. And his involvement, he is the author of 10 books or more, and he is an expert on development.
So yes. I see he's going to be talking about business trade missions to African
yes.
nations, agricultural developments, and efforts to combat the Ebola virus.
Yes. We are very pleased to have a doctor, Dr. Butera from Alvarado Hospital, who will give us more insight on the virus, how it's contracted, and we will have open discussion about some of the things that we as a country are doing to alleviate or to help us to, one, understand more about the virus, mm-hmm. and two, to alleviate some of the fears about having that virus come to our country.
Right. You don't catch it by casual contact, for
no.
example.
No, you do not. And also the efforts for screening, sometimes the government will move into that, mm-hmm. but
yeah, I've heard they're going to start screenings in 5 of the major airports in the United States now. That's the news as of this week.
As, yes.
Regarding screening people who are coming in from the countries that are known to have Ebola outbreaks
exactly.
already.
Exactly. So we will have an open discussion, question and answers on this Ebola virus with an expert in the field.
Well, very good. Now let's get to perhaps the most exciting news of all. Tell us a little bit about the presentation that's going to be done there by Atmospheric Water Solutions, which is a Honolulu-based company that had a technology being used over there in Hawaii already to
yes.
create drinkable water from air.
This is the most exciting, futuristic kind of technology because we must look at solutions that will deal with future solutions. We know that the past solutions have not alleviated the problems of giving water to the people, and we perhaps can look to a new way of doing this. Mm-hmm. And everybody has air. Someone asked, well, does that mean we have to choose between breathing and drinking? The answer is no. We believe yeah. that this technology will go a very long way in supporting giving people sustainable, alkaline, drinkable water in ways that will not require digging a well, or even buying a water tank to capture and hold water. It regenerates every 24 hours.
So can you tell us a little bit about how the technology works and roughly what it would cost to produce enough drinking water for, say, a household or a city?
We focus on the rural areas, so we are looking at the smaller, more affordable technology, mm-hmm. and that's what the blessing is. This is affordable technology. For about $3,000, we can generate up to 8 gallons of water on a 24-hour basis, mm-hmm. and this water is pure, safe, alkaline, and drinkable water. The next bump up would allow 24 gallons of water to be created in 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So for, say, a clinic or a larger facility that would want a little more, but the cost is right. We've been exposed to this technology, and to get it for a city, we're talking a small village, mm-hmm. $500,000, and we knew that that would not suffice. We couldn't even begin to look at it.
Right.
But now that the cost has come down, it's affordable.
Very interesting.
And the people in Honolulu are actually getting off the grid. They are producing safe water for their homes.
Yeah. Now Honolulu is in a very humid environment. Does the technology work in a climate that's typically drier, such as here in San Diego? Would it work in East County?
That was the first question that we asked when we wanted to vet and learn more about the technology. And yes, we have adequate humidity. If you walk out in the morning and you see the dew that's on your grass, that is enough to make this technology available.
Very interesting. Well, certainly here in California, we're seeing some towns in Northern California that have run completely out of water. People that do not have a drop when they turn on the spigot right now. And it could happen, you know, potentially other places. I know there's been concerns about groundwater depletion in parts of East County. So it seems like this might be something that could hold promise for some of those areas.
It is absolutely technology that we should expose ourselves to, because the Colorado River is not going to continue to support us. Northern California has said no to Southern California, and we must look at newer technology and better ways to supply ourselves with the water that we need.
Very good. So if they come to the conference, which again is, it's called the Africa Trade and Business Conference, October 18th, San Diego City College, will they see an actual demonstration of how this works?
Yes, they will, Miriam. We actually have a machine that will be here, and we will plug that machine in the morning, and people that participate in the conference can drink the water that we have right here in our own air.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, it certainly sounds like a wonderful opportunity to learn an awful lot about water issues, creating water from air, as well as you've mentioned, about the Ebola virus and some of the other things of interest to people involved in trade and business with Africa, or who are interested in getting into that, I would imagine, too.
Yes, and it exposes our young people to thinking outside of the box. It gives our youth an opportunity to see science on the forefront of creating ways of better living for our society.
Very good. Listeners, if you want more information about the conference, and there's a very nominal donation, I understand, requested for that, you can visit waterforchildrenafrica.org. That's www.waterforchildrenafrica.org. Vicki, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show and also to see you again.
Well, thank you. Vicki's an old friend. I've known her for many years, and it's just a delight to have you here today.
Thank you.
And to see what wonderful work you're continuing to do.
Thanks.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they leave Paris?
This is Miriam Raftery with today's Agricultural Report. efforts by the state of California to crack down on labor law violations could have a chilling effect on the local wine industry. Small wineries have been flourishing here since San Diego County passed its boutique winery ordinance, with new vintners springing up across our region. But unlike most small businesses, wineries that grow their own grapes can't generate profits for several years, since it takes that long after planting vines to produce the first wines, after first aging the vintages. It can take even longer to perfect winemaking techniques tailored to the microclimate and varietals grown at each winery's location. Many local wineries have relied on friends and other volunteers to pick grapes, help out at events and other tasks, a tradition in the winemaking industry. But California labor law prohibits for-profit businesses from using volunteers. Workers are required to be paid, and the employer must purchase workers' compensation insurance. Now, the California Division of Labor Standard Enforcement is putting the squeeze on those who don't comply. Westover Winery in Livermore Valley has been assessed over $115,000 in fines for allowing adult students in a winemaking class to get free hands-on experience at the winery. William Smythe, owner of Westover Winery, says he didn't need all those volunteers, but he adds, they enjoyed being part of our clubs and they loved helping out. My licensed winery consultant handled all the scheduling, and even she didn't know about this law, says Smythe, WineBusiness.com reports. He agreed to provide back pay to the workers, many of whom are retirees, who have said they don't need or want to be paid. But when some of the volunteers tried to return the money, voicing outrage at the state's action, the winery owner was fined even more, since it's illegal for an employer to take money back from an employee. Smith says he is being forced to shut down his winery now rather than file a costly and time-consuming appeal that he could lose. His winery was largely a hobby, and he has stated that he cannot afford to stay in business and pay six-figure salaries, since his profit last year was only $11,000. Wendell Lee, attorney for the Wine Institute, is advising wineries to speak with a labor attorney and take steps to become compliant with this law if they are in violation. He recommends that wineries now put all volunteers on the payroll and obtain employment and workers' compensation for all their employees. But that could be a costly proposition. Too costly for some mom-and-pop wineries to afford, critics contend. Meanwhile, Smythe hopes to help other wineries by asking his local representatives to amend the state law and exempt small wineries and other small businesses from the law, allowing them to use volunteers, just as nonprofits and government entities already do, under certain circumstances. He also wants to see businesses given a cease and desist order and the opportunity to become compliant before any fines are levied. In addition, he would like to see the Labor Department do more to outreach and inform wineries about the law. But such a measure could face opposition from labor and raise objections to granting exemptions from state labor law to some types of businesses, but not others. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. 10 years ago, San Diego State University changed its mascot, replacing Monty Montezuma with an Aztec warrior. The change was made to avoid negative stereotyping of Native Americans and was reportedly done in consultation with Aztec scholars in the United States and Mexico to honor the Aztecs' battlefield heroism and achievements. But now one student group thinks that changing didn't go far enough. The SDSU Queer People of Color Collective has launched a resolution calling on the student body to abandon all Aztec references, which they say perpetuates harmful stereotypes of Native Americans as savage and dangerous. The group objects to the new mascot's use of a spear at events and the slogan, "Fear the Spear," printed on uniforms and Aztec memorabilia. Back in 2000, a whopping 95% of the SDSU students voted to preserve the Aztec mascot, and the controversy made national news. Madison Hopkins is managing editor of the campus newspaper, The Daily Aztec. She says the petitioners haven't suggested an alternative mascot and suggests that alumni want to keep the Aztec warrior. Perhaps, she suggests, some fear an outcome similar to what happened at Stanford, where after administrators decided to dump the school's Indian mascot, the replacement was a bland red letter S with a tree. Hardly a fighting spirit to arouse the passions of football fans. not to mention the UC Santa Cruz banana slugs. David Frecker is president of the Society of Professional Journalists chapter at SDSU. He points out that the Viejas and Siquan tribes are major sponsors of the university, which would seem to debunk the notion that the school's symbol is racist towards Indians. The Daily Aztec's editor spoke with SDSU's chief communications officer, Greg Block, to ask if the university will be reconsidering the use of the Aztec warrior, UT San Diego reports. His response? We are the Aztecs, and we have every intention of remaining the Aztec. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Leon Thompson with our Green Scene Report. Federal protection as an endangered species has been granted to the yellow-billed cuckoo, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has announced. The listing covers portions of 12 states, including California. Since 1980, 9 sightings of the yellow-billed cuckoo have been made in San Diego County, though no nests have been found since the 1930s, according to the San Diego Bird Atlas Project at San Diego State University. Locally, the birds have been spotted from May to August, most commonly in strands of riparian willows and cottonwoods. This insect-eating bird winters in South America and breeds in western North America. Once abundant across the West, its population has been declining for decades due mainly to the loss of its riparian woodland habitats. Designation of the yellow-billed cuckoo as a federally protected endangered species was made after extensive input from scientists and the public, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says. The endangered species listing means that next, steps will be taken to designate critical habitat for the species and develop a recovery plan. Those steps will be strengthened by the participation from other federal and state agencies, Native American tribes, and the public. Comments are being accepted through October 14th at regulations.gov. You can get details at our website, eastcountymagazine.org, in our Green Living section.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Kirk Lee Ader, author and photographer of the nonfiction book Child of the Storm, which recounts the life and surfing career of San Diego surf star Chris O'Rourke. My guest's work has appeared in publications such as Sports Illustrated, Outside, Islands, and Surfer, along with many international magazines. Ader has also co-authored Big Island Days and the Great Hawaii Sports Journal. Child of the Storm is his third book. Welcome, Kirk. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back in San Diego here. I grew up here, and it's always great to come back.
Let's start with a little historical information about Chris O'Rourke. I know that he also grew up in San Diego County, and at age 16, he became the number one rated surfer from mainland United States. He had only one goal, as I understand it, to become a world champion. Without giving too much away about your book, what happened to Chris and his dream, and how did you become involved in it?
Chris's story is very dynamic yet complex at the same time. He's actually originally from the East Coast, where the O'Rourke family all grew up, but they came to San Diego in the mid to late 60s and for various reasons had to almost flee the East Coast. And Chris and his father had a bit of a rift going on. When they arrived in San Diego, Chris didn't really want anything to do with surfing. He didn't like it at all. But his older brother, Bart, started surfing, and eventually Chris became hooked by it, too. And it really, he accelerated in surfing very, very quickly, learned how to surf at La Jolla Shores. Eventually, the family moved up towards Windansea, which, of course, a lot of people know can be a very localized surfing spot. Mm-hmm. Chris, with O'Rourke's, is a Irish background there, and Chris had a kind of a fiery temper, and once he got out into the wind and sea lineup and learned how to surf even better and better, he really released a lot of anger, I think, that he felt towards his father through his surfing, and he just fit right into the scene at Wind and Sea. And before he knew it, his surfing just accelerated, and he became a very dynamic force and became very, very good at what he did.
Now, how did you become involved with him? How did you meet him and witness his life?
Sure. I actually first met him briefly when I was going to Scripps Elementary in La Jolla Shores in the sixth grade. The family had actually moved back to New York temporarily for a few months, but returned to La Jolla, and he was in my school for a few months. Then they moved back uptown, La Jolla, and then from there, he was in my grade at Mirlands Junior High in La Jolla, and then also in La Jolla High. And I started shooting surfing photographs in about the 10th grade at La Jolla High School. Mm-hmm. And at that time, well, Chris was the number one rated surfer from the U.S. mainland. So if I was going to get anywhere in my photography, he was the guy that I was going to shoot. I had the best guy right there. And I made it a point to try to shoot photos of him whenever possible. And that really kicked the whole thing off.
And what was it like seeing him surf that close and photographing it?
It was incredible. At the time, you know, in the mid-70s, surfing was kind of a misunderstood sport. The professionalism part was just getting off the ground. And surfing was searching for an identity. Was it an art form? Was it a sport? But there were a lot of people that were trying to elevate it to a higher level, and even Chris at a young age was one of those. He was a prodigy surfer in so many ways, just like 11-time world champion Kelly Slater is today. Mm-hmm. He was winning all the contests. He was beating the guys 10 years older than him. He elevated through the ranks of what was called the WSA, Western Surfing Association. And he got put in the 4A category when he was 14 years old. That's how good he was, because normally that division is reserved for surfers 18 years old or older. Mm-hmm. He just really elevated through the ranks very fast. And before you know it, he was right there at the top. When the WSA folded in 1976, Chris was the number one rated surfer in the 4A division. And then when the Pro Tour started that same year, he was all set to go on the Pro Tour, but unfortunately, he was still in high school, so he kind of had to wait till the following year in 1977, which he did. But he was the first guy from California to really lead the charge and take it to the rest of the world. At that time, surfing was dominated by South Africans, Hawaiians, and Australians.
Wow. So. Do you remember what you thought when you first saw him surf?
I thought he was a dominant force, and he definitely stood out far above the rest of the surfers that I saw in the water through his maneuvers and everything. He was clearly the best guy out there.
And what a challenge to capture it on film.
And on film, it was great. Of course, back then, it was manual focus cameras,
right,
and shooting slide film, and not like the technology we have today, which is, of course, great. So you kind of had to be conservative also, too, in how you shot your film, because every press of the button of the shutter cost you money. So, but with Chris, it was good, because all the maneuvers he did were very, very strong.
Now, I know that Chris died before his time of cancer in 1981, and you're quoted as saying that his story is not about duration, but about brilliance.
That's correct.
What lessons do you believe are highlighted by Chris for anyone who reads about them?
I think the first really key lesson is that, and I'm a firm believer in this, if you have your health, you have everything. And anybody who's healthy, if you know, there's always going to be other troubles and good things and bad things in your life. But obviously cancer is a big factor for a lot of people today. Both my parents have had cancer. They're still alive today. They've been able to battle it. But what I learned from Chris is if you're healthy, you have a lot. And I'm reminded of that all the time in my own life. If I ever have a bad day, all I have to do is think about Chris, and it really kind of kicks me back into place and realize, well, again, I'm healthy, I have good things going on, and I try to look at it that way. He had some family issues, too, and I think if you have a strong family, that's good. There's so many variables in this book to talk about and to go through. It really touches on a lot of different aspects of life, tragedy, turmoil, greatness, friendships, and ultimately inspiration, which he did. He inspired so many people by his fight for survival and to go through life, and he fought right up until the very end.
Now, do you see his surfing as a metaphor of that kind of, I don't know, strength and endurance, or do you see it as the beauty of the sport?
Most definitely, surfing kept him alive, in my opinion, longer than he should have survived. He got such a strength from going out in the ocean and surfing. And he also got really a lot of strength because he had a wife and a son. And those three factors right there really played a big role, I think, in extending his life. Surfing, though, he was drawn to the ocean like a magnet. Mm-hmm. And the ocean, of course, when you're surfing, there's so many variables and factors out there. It's not just the surfing on the wave itself, but the environment of being in the ocean. Right. And that really played a large part in his life. And
passion.
Passion, exactly.
Well, speaking of passion, you've had a long career as a photojournalist. Give us an inside look what it's like to photograph surfers and other amazing things to see and photograph. How do you get the right shot? And what's the process of capturing an exciting sport like that?
Well, I'm going to back up again here. Surfing in the mid-70s was kind of just searching for an identity. Now, today, there's a $1 billion industry behind it, and it's really come a long way. For me to shoot surfing from the mid-70s up until today, I've seen a lot of that progress, and I've been able to go out and shoot events on the pro tour at different countries around the world and see guys come and go from different countries. And it's really been great to see how surfing has progressed as a sport, the maneuvers, the art form itself, and all the different identities that have evolved, and that's been the greatest thing. In the mid-70s, you had just surfing. Surfing spread then and created other sports like windsurfing, kite surfing, even other sports like land sports like snowboarding. So it's the evolution of the whole thing is what's been great to witness, and there's been certainly a lot of that. And surfing has gone from just being, you know, thought of in the old Gidget movies and the Beach Boy music and all that today, like I said, to this $1 billion industry with huge companies like Quiksilver and Billabong, and it's really been a great thing.
But how do you get close enough to photograph the exciting moments?
Well, of course, you have your water cameras. You're swimming out there in the water, which is takes a lot of skill and expertise to get in, you know, on the wave and be on the wave, and you can shoot. Mostly you're swimming and trying to get in the right position, and that can be a difficult task depending on what surf spot you're shooting. But when you're not using the water camera, you use large telephoto lenses, just like when you're shooting football or something like that, and being on the beach and being able to capture the entire wave. And so it's either shooting with telephoto lenses or water cameras, but either way, it's a really neat and fun thing to do.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it is. Yeah. I have one more question for you, Kirk. Okay. What's next? What are you working on now?
Well, it's an extension of the Child of the Storm book. We're actually trying to get and very close to having the Child of the Storm book be picked up by a movie producer. And we're trying to get that done, and we're very close. But as everyone knows, I'm working with Hollywood and everything. It takes a while for these things to happen. But I'm hoping that in the next year that'll happen. I'm taking a little break from the writing part because The Child of the Storm took me 9 years to do. So it was pretty much a very extensive project, being that you're dealing with real people, real lives.
Sure.
So I decided to kind of take a break from that. And living in Hawaii, I just continue my photography over there.
Okay. Well, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me today again. It's been great.
For more information on Kirk Ader and his work, please visit his website at www.kirkaderphoto.com. And Ader is spelled A-E-D-E-R, kirkaderphoto.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
Voters interested in casting their ballots early for the November 4th gubernatorial general election can now do so at the County Registrar of Voters' new office at 5600 Overland Avenue in Kearny Mesa. Early voting will continue from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. The office also will be open 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. on November 1st and November 2nd for weekend voting and until polls close at 8 p.m. on Election Day. Approximately 850,000 mail ballots have been sent out. Voters who requested them are urged to act on them right away. Registrar Michael Vu states, if you know how you want to vote, grab that mail ballot when you get it, vote it, and send it back right away. The sooner we get the ballot back, the sooner we can start processing it so it will be counted right when the polls close at 8 p.m. on November 4th. Mail ballots are convenient for voters who would rather not make a special trip to the Registrar of Voters' office to cast their ballots or wait for the polls to open on Election Day. The Registrar is also offering another option. Starting October 27th through November 3rd, voters will be able to swing by any one of 15 locations located throughout the county to drop off their completed mail ballots. An insert with locations and additional information has been added to each mail ballot packet. Voters can still request a mail-in ballot until October 28th. Meanwhile, the Registrar is still looking for poll workers, especially bilingual poll workers. For more information, call 858-565-5800 or visit sdvote.com. This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.